Morning, Council. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is back in session. Judge Frisch, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Hooten, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Good morning, Council. Today is December 16, 2020. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're here on our second case on our oral argument calendar this morning. This is A-20-0951. And counsel, please correct me if I mispronounce the names of your clients, Jubara versus Hamed. And you can see that the marshal is showing a 15-minute running clock of your time. Please pay attention to your time. The appellant, both of you will have a 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'd ask that you identify yourself and your client before you begin your argument. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. This is Nahid Abul Hassan on behalf of the appellant, Nihat Salah Aoud Hamed. May it please the court, the appellant here filed for an appeal denying her motion to hold the respondent in contempt of court. The order denying her motion is very confusing. The court did not follow the four steps to determine whether or not the respondent should be held in contempt of court. The court clearly listed a bunch of cases, and I say it was confusing because the court cited civil procedure rules from 2004. We're in 2020. Also, some of the citation of some of the cases were not even complete. And after the court listed all of this old rules, the order section, the court just stated the motion to hold the respondent in contempt of court is denied. And the court very much listed two reasons. One of them says the court has broad discretion to hold the respondent in contempt of court. And the second reason the court cited is that there was no evidence of personal service.
Can I just ask you, are you disputing that service was not made of your motion upon the respondent here?
Well, service was attempted.
But it's never, service was not made. Am I correct?
Based on the court order, the court said no in-person appearance shall happen. So if I serve the respondent and he appeared, that would be in violation of the court order. I myself sent the motion to Metro Legal. The day we received the order from the court citing the governor's emergency order for no appearance, in-person appearance, I contacted Metro Legal and stopped the service. By the end of that process, Metro Legal sent my client a bill for making two attempts, $15 for each attempt, unsuccessful attempts, which my client paid.
But attempted service is not service. This was a motion for contempt, and the respondent to that motion has due process rights and has a right to appear to respond to the motion. And if the respondent doesn't get notice of the motion to be able to respond, then the motion doesn't proceed according to our rules. So what is the error here by the district court in these circumstances?
Counsel for the respondent waived personal service by filing correspondence with the court. Once I filed my motion, he filed correspondence with the court, asking the court not to appear in person because he has members in his family who are vulnerable to be affected by COVID-19. The court gave counsel an option, two options, to appear by phone or to appear by written submission. Counsel chose to appear by written submission. Based on his choice, the court issued an order directing the parties to submit the written submission by April 14th and file a responsive submission by April 21st.
Did the attorney ever raise the insufficient service as a issue before the court?
The court? Only when he responded after he requested not to appear in person and he submitted his motion, very much claiming the motion has to be denied. For what reason? We don't know. The second reason, he moved the court to hold an evidentiary hearing, which was barred by the doctrine of res judicata because we had a trial on this issue and the court determined who was credible. And also counsel tried to amend the finding that my client non-marital property worth $15,000 and the court denied his motion for amended findings. And counsel chose not to appeal that denial of his motion.
Do you agree that the court did not make a determination that this perfume was worth $15,000 in the judgment decree?
I don't agree with that.
Because I looked at the judgment decree. It just said that your client claimed it was $15,000. You're not saying that that represents the court's finding that it's $15,000, are you?
It is in the section of the finding. The court here did not order the respondent to pay $15,000 at that time. The court ordered him to send back the 14 containers within 2 weeks. The understanding of respondent counsel was clear. He amended that portion of the findings, asking the court to redetermine the value, which clearly showed he had no intention of returning the non-property itself. He understood the court made a determination and he appealed. He tried to amend that finding, which was finding 69. That by itself, Your Honor, proves that the respondent knew the court made a finding, my client's property worth $15,000, and he moved the court to devalue or to reassess that value. You can have it both ways. On one hand, he claims, please amend this finding. On the other hand, he says, oh, the court never made a finding. They don't go together, Your Honor. Here, counsel is playing with both. The same thing he did with service. He asked the court to waive personal service by his correspondence. Once that was accepted by court, and the court issued an order, which technically, based on 588.04, it is very much a reason to show cause. It's the court or the written submission to prove, to show the court whether the respondent should be held in contempt of court. That order technically is an order to show cause by written submission, which the respondent complied with. And after he complied with, he comes back to say there was no personal service. He's the one who moves the court not to have personal service.
I understand the dispute over the valuation, but at the end of the day, the district court has the discretion whether to impose contempt sanctions. And so, or not impose contempt sanctions based on its assessment of the case. And I'm having some difficulty understanding why what the district court did here was an abuse of its discretion. It found that contempt sanctions were not appropriate in this case. And what is the basis for us not to defer to that district court finding based on its intimate knowledge of the circumstances of this case?
If we follow the case law is clear. There are four steps the district court must take to determine whether to hold someone in contempt of court or not. The court did none of that. But
in those cases, those are the four steps that the district court must take if it is going to impose sanctions. Is there any case that you cite where the district where we've held or this Minnesota Supreme Court has held that the district court must undertake those findings or those four steps if it is declining to impose sanctions?
When the court cited a case that's not it's unlike the situation in this case. When there is confusion, there is miscommunication, yes, the court must do that. And here I'm referring to the New Strand case. But that case was about miscommunication between attorneys and their clients about parenting time, and that a misunderstanding did not show bad faith. Here, the four steps the court has to follow, we have a case, we have Hobb v. Hobb, and the Hobb clearly stated a proper exercise of civil contempt power requires the ordering court has jurisdiction. Here we have jurisdiction per finding of fact 17. The court clearly said whoever doesn't comply with this order, the person who is injured by non-compliance can seek the assistance of the court, and the court will be awarding, shall be, the person who, the non-compliant person shall be ordered to pay attorney's fees. The court here undid its own order. That's the court retained jurisdiction by that. I have the case here, the Hobb versus Hobb. The second requirement is for the court to determine if the decree clearly defined what has to be performed. The court clearly said you have to deliver, you must deliver these 14 containers within 2 weeks. That didn't happen. Counsel argued that the order was ambiguous. There is no ambiguity here. Number three, the party directed to perform had notice of the court decree and a reasonable time. He had notice. The decree was interim May 31st, 2019. His counsel filed a notice of filing and judgment and decree. His counsel filed a motion on July 1st, 2019 to amend that portion, which is finding of FAS 69 to devalue the perfume. All of this proof he had noticed. His client filed several motions. His client appeared in court for the amended finding motion. He had notice. He also had enough time to comply. I sent several emails to opposing counsel, which he ignored to respond to. This was interim May 31st, 2019. Once he filed a motion for amended finding, I did not send any other request until the court denied respondent motion. I let 60 days pass so that order is final because counsel didn't appeal it. And then it's barred by res judicata now to argue the same thing. And then I started making requests again, which were ignored. In one email, counsel said, you know there is no perfume. How counsel would know I know?
Well, could I ask you this? I mean, because it looks to me that the judge really was making a legal determination that contempt is an extraordinary remedy, and that this is not the appropriate use of the contempt statute to enforce a dissolution property settlement, and that there are other, that this is not what you use, because a property settlement is just an ordinary debt. This is a very serious, extraordinary remedy, because you're putting people in jail if they don't follow it. And why should this property matter be something why should it be treated any different than an ordinary debt? I mean, we don't have debtor's prison, right?
We ask the court to give us a judgment as a remedy.
But the motion was for contempt.
Yes, we asked the court to set the person as a judgment.
But the judge ruled on the motion that was brought was a motion for contempt.
Yes, because instructed us by finding of fact 17, if anybody does not comply, the person who's injured by this can motion the court to enforce. How do you enforce an order of the court? A contempt of court is not a motion to send someone to jail. A contempt of court by case
it is, because you can give purge conditions, and if they don't comply with the purge conditions. That's why there's so many steps in contempt, and that's set forth in the Hop case. But it's a very serious matter. And you have used this extraordinary remedy to basically resolve a property dispute.
To ensure future compliance. Here, if the court said, okay, I am not holding the respondent in contempt, but here you have a judgment for $15,000, go collect it, that would have ended.
Okay, but that's different. That's different. You brought a motion for contempt.
Yes, and because the direction from the court was clear. And the respondent kept arguing with the court by repeating the same argument he made several times. He is not trying to say, I don't have the property of the appellant. He's trying to say several times, I do have the property, but I want the court to reassess its value. The issue is clear here. The respondent himself is not denying that he has the property of the appellant. He just chose not to surrender it. He keeps arguing about the value, which clearly shows the bad faith intent. You hold someone...
Counsel, I see that your time has expired. So if you just want to wrap up very quickly.
I believe there is no any other remedy for the appellant to get her... property order unless she seeks enforcement measures. One of them is to motion the court to bring the respondent in compliance. The respondent chose not to. The respondent is not disputing he has her property. The court, by denying her motion and not directing or giving us other remedies, very much reopened the judgment and decree and re-awarded my client non-marital property back respondent, which the court doesn't have jurisdiction to do so.
All right. Thank you, counsel. All right. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Anything else from the panel this morning? All right. Thank you. Counsel, go ahead.
Good morning, everyone. May it please the court, Maury Beaulieu for the petitioner respondent in this appeal, Dia Jubara. And if I'm talking too loud, please let me know. I tend to shout when I'm on a computer because I'm afraid you can't hear me. But
you're fine, counsel. Your volume's good.
I think counsel kind of lays out the problems with her appeal right from the get-go. First of all, she misstates the facts of the case, somehow claiming that Mr. Jubara claimed he has the property. Both in the testimony at trial and in his affidavit in response to the motion, he indicates he does not have the property. He documents his search for it. He's not trying to change the outcome in terms of, I just want to keep the property. He says he does not have it. Counsel also clearly ignores the standard of review, which is an abuse of discretion, where it has to be clearly erroneous for this court to reverse it. She ignores the process that has to be filed for contempt. Those processes are put in place for the person who's the alleged contemptor. It's not there so that the person who is alleging contempt can say, this is the process, I want this process put in place. It's for the contemptor to have due process because they're facing potential jail time, which is one of the remedies she asked for in her motion. I think it's extremely compelling that appellant does not address at all the procedural issues in this case until just now in her oral argument. It was not addressed at the trial court level. It's not addressed in her brief, but it's unrefuted that the motion for contempt was never personally served. And she argues that somehow it was waived by asking for arguments in writing. That's not a waiver of personal service. And I would point the court to some of the rules of procedure. A similar rule is Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 4.03, which requires personal service of a summons in a civil action or something acknowledged by mail. So there has to be some written acknowledgement that service occurred. There was none of that in this case. The appellant never brought up that they even attempted to personally serve Mr. Jubara until today. There's no evidence in the record that personal service was even attempted until just today in this argument. Instead, the only service that occurred was electronic service through the electronic filing system. The determination of whether a service process is proper is a question of law, and I report further court to Amdahl versus Stonewall Insurance Company, 484 Northwest 2nd, 811, Minneapp, 1992. And in this case, the record contains no evidence that any order to show cause or any motion was personally served on Mr. Jubara. We also raised additional issues procedurally, where any motion that is filed has to include some affidavit of personal knowledge specifically indicating what provision of the order has been violated and how it has been violated. Counsel herself has no personal knowledge of the situation, yet she is the one who submitted the affidavit, not her client. There is nothing that supports the motion for contempt in that regard. So that leaves us with the question, is contempt an appropriate remedy? And of course, the honorable judges here have read the case law. It is an extraordinary remedy. It gives the trial court great discretion in determining whether it's an appropriate remedy, and they won't be disturbed if they don't violate that great and broad discretion. Clearly, there was no remedy here where my client says he doesn't have the asset. They claim he does have the asset. He can't produce it. He has no keys to his freedom.
As to that issue, did the court make a finding in that regard as to whether he could, whether he had it or didn't have it?
I think it made a finding that he had to turn it over. So that is a finding, at least inherently, that he did have it. But
I'm just looking at the order denying contempt. And can you show me in the order where the judge made a determination that he didn't have it, so he couldn't comply anyway?
I don't think that is in the findings, but the court did determine that it made a determination that it's not an appropriate remedy.
Well, but is that determination that it's not an appropriate remedy, can we tell from this order what that is based upon? Is this a matter of law? Or just as a matter of the facts and the...
I think it's a matter of interpretation. I didn't mean to interrupt you there. But I think it's not unprecedented, and we provided some unpublished cases to show it's not unprecedented for a court to simply decline finding contempt based on the motion where there is no useful purpose. And we cited the Bowman case. Actually, that's a case that actually... is published, 493 Northwest 2nd, 141, Minneapp, 1992, where it determined that the contempt finding would not have been warranted under the circumstances. That's what the trial court determined, and they upheld that. And
is the determination by the court that it's not an appropriate mechanism for resolving this, is that a legal matter, or is that based on the facts that were presented?
It's based on the facts presented. I think it comes specifically from everything presented. The court had, this was a long case. The trial or the case itself was longer than the marriage of the parties. So, and there was a long 2-day trial. So the court had a great deal of evidence it looked at. It was aware of all the facts. And I think it based it on those facts.
But how can we, as a reviewing court, review facts that weren't made?
Well,
I mean, there's no determination as to whether he could comply or not comply.
Fair enough. I also think that the court can determine, though, whether it's an appropriate remedy, whether or not it says he can comply or not. Keep in mind, the asset that we're talking about here is homemade perfume, where they buy some chemicals and a family member mixes them together. There's nothing been provided that there's any market for that or any value to that other than my client's testimony on what he paid for certain chemicals. But other than that, there's no determination of value. So I don't know how you would, I think based on that, a court can determine that there's just no remedy here. You can't lock somebody up and say, provide something when they say they don't have it and they provided information they don't have it. The property remedy would be potentially a going to civil court and getting a valuation of it, or a writ of execution, going there to pick it up if it's there. Those are really the remedies that are available.
Well, how do you respond to the appellant's argument that that really all she wants and what she requested was that the court just give her a judgment for $15,000?
You can't just, well, first of all, that's obviously a substantive change of a final property settlement. So she's arguing it's a final property settlement and res judicata, so we can't have a revaluation of it. But then she's arguing, I want the court to put a value on this and give me a remedy that is not in the property settlement itself, which is a substantive change of the property settlement. So you can't do that, obviously. I think she's right. I don't think the court actually could have reopened it to revalue it either. I don't think that's an appropriate remedy. I think it is res judicata. And the court can certainly, it's axiomatic that the court can interpret its own order. There's lots of case law that indicates that. And the court said, I didn't find a value of $15,000. I put in the testimony of the appellant, which was that she said it was worth $15,000, with, by the way, no support for that.
Do you want to address the issue of the attorney's fees? Because she's claiming conduct-based attorney's fees.
And I think it's pretty clear that the court has broad discretion in that regard as well. And it has to be when it's not based on need, it's somebody who unreasonably contributes to the length and expense of a proceeding under Minnesota Statutes 518.14 Subdivision 1. It's reviewed based on an abuse of discretion, and conduct occurring outside the litigation process can't support an award of conduct-based attorney's fees. And that's Geske versus Marcelina, 624 Northwest 2nd, 813, Minnesota App, 2001. I think the court was well within its discretion by not awarding attorney's fees. And in part, I think it is based on what has been a pretty vexatious litigation by the appellant in this case, on a marriage where the parties were together essentially 1 year and 10 days. It's just gone on and on and on. And I have nothing further, and I'll cede the rest of my time if you have no more questions.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Is there anything else from the panel this morning? All right. Thank you very much. Counsel, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You're muted, counsel. Thank you.
The civil procedure rules are clear. Personal service may be waived if your first response to the court, you don't raise that objection. Here, I file a motion on March 20th, 2020. On March 24th, counsel for respondent file a letter saying, I want to move by in person. Didn't raise that there was no personal service in this case. Also, after the court responded to counsel filed a motion, a responsive motion on March 25th, 2020. By his motion, he did not raise that there was no personal service proof. So personal service is unlike subject matter jurisdiction. Personal jurisdiction here, counsel never raised it down at the level. If you don't raise it, you lose it. He waived the personal service. That's number one. With regard to, he just conceded that revaluating the property is barred by res judicata. But I don't understand how counsel would move the court by his motion stating that in the event the court find a prima facie case for contempt has been made, he asked the court to grant an evidentiary hearing to revalue the property. This is the fourth time. Here, conduct-based attorney's fees was not an issue. The court has no jurisdiction. I understand conduct-based attorney's fees is based on the discretionary power of the court. But here we have a clear order from the court. The court said, if you don't comply, the person who tries to enforce the judgment terms that the non-compliant party caused shall pay attorney's fees. So here, attorney's fees is not only, it's not limited. It's not, now it's just based on the court order. That was the court order asked us to do. We followed what the court told us.
So your argument is essentially that the district court was obligated and had no discretion and must enter contempt sanctions.
Yes, because...
What's the legal authority for that proposition?
A final order. We have a judgment and decree stating if you don't comply, the injured, you shall pay the injured person. And that's final. Counsel did not appeal that part of the finding of fact.
Yes, but that doesn't mandate the district court to enter contempt sanctions. I mean, there is a statute that indicates that contempt sanctions are permissive within the discretion of the district court. And I believe that all of our authority provides that contempt sanctions are discretionary.
Well, here,
so
I'm talking
what's the legal authority? What's the case law that supports your proposition that contempt sanctions must be awarded under these circumstances?
Well, I'm discussing attorney's fees, Your Honor, based on first, he caused my client fine by not complying, by repeating the same argument. That's the discretionary part. That's the conduct based. Number two is the judgment and decree itself directed him to pay my attorney's fees, my client attorney's fees.
No, I understand that the judgment and decree provides that contempt sanctions may be entered if there's noncompliance with the judgment and decree and the order of the district court. But what I'm asking is, what's the legal authority that requires the district court to actually impose the sanction?
Its own judgment and decree.
And you think that should be done regardless of the fact that, you know, that the respondent here claims that he didn't have it. He can't comply.
No. Here, this is based on the fact that the court repeatedly denied his request that this property doesn't exist. I refer the court to the transcript, which I attached to my responsive motion. There was a lengthy, lengthy testimony by both parties. The credibility of the witness rests on the district court. The court heard from both parties. My client testified she had a suitcase worth of 50 pounds of homemade perfume, 50 pounds. And she went in detail describing how she reached that $15,000 value. And the court found her more credible than the respondent. He can't come back over and over and over to try to claim and misstate facts saying that there is no testimony here. We had a trial on this issue.
All right. Thank you, counsel. I see your time has expired. Are there any other questions from the panel? All right. The matter is submitted. We will issue an opinion within the statutory time period. Thank you very much, counsel. We'll stand in recess until our next case.